Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football. Just a quick word of thanks to the thousands and thousands of you that have listened to the show so far. We've had many new listeners in the past few months and wonderful to see so many people getting to know the history of Irish football, both North and South. This week we're rewinding back to the very first show where we looked at the origins of Irish football on the island. How did it all begin? Who were the first clubs? And how did association football take hold? Here is our very first show. The origins of Irish football.
It's 1878 in Edinburgh, Scotland. The manager of the Irish Tweed House Company of Belfast, John McCready McAleary, is making his way around the densely populated streets. It's a busy place, crisscrossed with railway and tram. As he rounds a corner, he can hear a crowd shouting and cheering. He manages to make his way to a point where he can see what it's all about. On a field in front of him are men running around with a ball at their feet. This is new. He's never seen anything like this before. As the match ends, John shuffles off with the rest of the crowd. The boat back to Belfast. He just can't get it out of his head. Excited about this new game he's seen, he thinks, what if we had something like this? When he gets back, he petitions for an exhibition game in the city. And with the help of Ulster and Windsor rugby clubs, on the 24th of October 1878, two Scottish teams, Queen's Park and Caledonian FC, play at the Ulster Cricket Grounds. And that's how Ireland starts its footballing journey. Or, at least, that's how the story goes. But is that really how it all began? Could it really be that simple? Well, let's find out. So Gary, we had that little kind of story at the start of our show. How true is it, I suppose, and where do we actually begin with the origins of Irish football?
Well, it is a great story, and it is an important milestone in the history of Irish football. And if you actually read the record books, the history books written by great men such as Malcolm Brodie or Peter Byrne, the John McAleary story is very important. But unfortunately, like many great stories, there are some facts that actually contradict the legend. So the legend, as you said, is that John McAleary, on his honeymoon in Scotland, saw a game of football and thought it would be a great idea. And he brought it back, arranged this challenge game, which certainly was very significant, between Queen's Park and Caledonian. And he also went on to found Cliftonville FC and the heavily involved in founding the Irish Football Association in 1880. Now, there's a couple of issues with that. The first issue is John McAleary didn't get married until 1879. So the exhibition match was already held. He presumably hadn't gone on honeymoon at this stage. But even if he was in Scotland, there is history and historical records of football having been played on this island before that exhibition match.
If we take it before that, is there football, as we know it, or back then, being played on the island of Ireland before that, and what does it look like?
You see, well, there was always, for many hundreds of years, some form of football played. But there was no structure, no organised rules. I suppose if you take it into the history of the sport in these islands as well, which is probably more important than how it spread, in that I suppose what we know today as rugby football or rugby union was the two sports probably, they split more than anything else. And even that legend is not correct. I mean, the legend is that in, I think it's 1823, in rugby school in England, William Webb Ellis became the first man to run with a ball in his hands. Now, that's not even true. The Rugby World Cup is called after him, but that's actually historically incorrect. And that wasn't allowed in rugby school for many years afterwards. And they reckon the first man in rugby to run with a ball in his hand was a guy called Jem Mackey, who was expelled in disgrace. And so they gave the legend to William Webb Ellis. So it should be the Jem Mackey Cup. That,
look at this. Anyway, we're busting all the myths here.
Well, I mean, that's actually not my research. That's actually been well researched and probably ignored. But from a football point of view, there were some clubs in England, and in 1863, the Football Association was founded, and they came up with what are the laws of the game. And the first international match was England-Scotland in 1872. There was the first FA Cup. And there was a bit of a schism between football and rugby at the time. And so if you're talking about something like association rules, you're talking about football. So football thrived in England and Scotland. It was mainly in England in the public schools. It was very much a middle-class game until, let's say, a lot of the clubs in the north introduced professionalism, brought players down from Scotland, etc. There were actually different rules in Scotland as well. But we can come on to that at more at a later stage. But from organised football on this island, there's some things we can't really confirm. I mean, there's a Coleraine football historian, Grant Cameron, who insists that there was games played by Scottish soldiers in Coleraine in the 1860s. Cliftonville Football Club, founded in 1879 by John McLeary, is generally considered to be the oldest football club on this island. Now, that is disputed. Limavady still claim there was a club called Alexander, and there certainly was an Alexander Cricket Club in 1876, and they insist that they had the first football club.
And is it the... And again, not getting into so much into the argument, but is it a sign of the time, though, that there is football going on, not just in kind of, we'll say, concentrated areas like up in the north, Belfast, or in the east in Dublin and stuff like that? There's an all-Ireland encompassing thing here where there's football being played. It might not be the football that kind of generally sets itself along the same rules as each other, but they're playing a game of football across the island.
Yeah, definitely.
And so that's where those disputes come from. It's those, oh, we started this time, we started here, and it kind of dots around.
Yeah, and I mean, some of these cases were rugby clubs becoming football clubs. So there was definitely football happening, okay? So there's reports of football happening in Tuam, in Galway, in 1875, 76. A newspaper called the Cork Constitution. What a fantastic name for a newspaper. But on the 28th of November, in 28th of November 1877, the Cork Constitution reported on a football match played under association rules in Mallow County, Cork, between Pens of Mallow and Lismore of Waterford. And the game ended in a scoreless draw. Now, there's reports there was meant to be a rematch, but it never made the newspapers. There almost certainly were other football matches happening at this time all around the country. There was reports of games up in Westmeath, in Kings County. In fact, there's a strong argument that Sligo Football Club were actually founded before Cliftonville in 1879. They appear to have been playing games in 1879, 1880 and 1881 and have a much stronger argument than Alexander or Limavady to being the first football club on this island. But that seems to have... So that means actually there was a Sligo rugby club that probably switched to football around that period. But really, football grew organically. Now, that's not to take away from the importance of that game in 1878, because that was a big deal. That was a major game. Two Scottish sides were brought over. But it also has to be said that in 1854, DUFC, Dublin University Football Club, now, it's generally accepted as Trinity College and it's a rugby club, but they were part of a Scottish plan to organise games in Dublin and Belfast in 1876 and 1877. but they actually fell through. And there's no record of those games happening. So, but definitely in 1878, in Belfast, Queen's Park played Caledonian. Queen's Park won 3-1. It was organised, as you said, by the two rugby clubs, Windsor and Ulster football clubs. The admission money, gentlemen paid 6d to get in, ladies were free.
Like the race.
Certainly, well,
it was very much sales.
Yeah, very much different times, etc. Now, interestingly, the credit for that, right up, so Malcolm Brodie, who I mentioned earlier, he's generally accepted as the foremost historian going back on football north of the border. He passed away there a few years ago, but he had been at every Northern Ireland game going back to 1946. He published many books and history on the subject. Interestingly, in 1963, when he references that game, he gives the credit to the Windsor and Ulster football clubs. But in the centenary history of Cliftonville in 1979, they make a big deal about John McLeary's involvement and that the whole honeymoon story, etc., comes in. And in Malcolm's centenary history of the IFA a year later, he does go with the John McLeary story. And I think that's where it gets picked up. But as I said, there's been a lot of research done, particularly by a historian in Belfast by the name of Martin Moore, who published a paper on this and has actually proven historical facts. But notwithstanding that, that game was hugely significant. It introduced football. There were games to follow. Games, I mean, I think Cliftonville went and played Ayr United or Ayr from Scotland. There was a game against a team called Lensleys, who are from Dumbarton. Again, a huge Scottish influence on the game.
Is that influence purely geographical, as in it's literally a short boat ride to Scotland and the two just bounce off each other?
I think so, from a Belfast perspective, because there's Scottish rules that were actually available in Belfast in 1875. That's been documented and in contemporary newspapers. Whereas the association rules, which would be the Football Association, because, of course, the English FA, or the FA as they're known, are the original. So they never used the title England. They were just the football, and they are to this day, the Football Association. Mm. Whereas everybody else is the Football Association of Ireland, the Irish Football Association, the Scottish Football Association, the Football Association of Wales, etc., etc. Everybody else has got their national name in their title, apart from the FA. So if you look at the games south of what is now the border, which of course didn't exist in those days, there's talk of association rules. And there is, again, records of association rules being available in Dublin back in those days. And I actually don't know, I haven't really gone down the rabbit hole of the differences between the rules. But at the time, the games were played under the rules of the home association. So Scotland played England in Glasgow, it was played under Scottish rules. And if they played in London or south of the border, it was under the FA, the Football Association rules.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. And where does we see this kind of dotting around the country, around the island, from around about what, 1860, 1870-ish? When does it become a little bit more, I suppose, streamlined and a bit more definitive that we can see kind of clubs and teams coming together?
Okay, so as I said, well, Cliftonville, with a shout out to Alexander, but more importantly, I think a shout out to Sligo, which is a strong case. But Cliftonville are generally accepted as being the oldest club in this island. They were founded in 1879. The Irish Football Association was founded in 1880. So that was the first signs of structure of clubs coming together. The first Irish Cup final was held in 1881. Another important club actually is Myola Park from Castle Dawson in County Derry. So they took the name of the estate of Lord Spencer Chichester, who provided land for them. And they actually won the first Irish Cup in 1881. So that was a knockout competition, the first proper structured football on this island. The first FA Cup had happened 9 years earlier in 1872. So the Irish Cup continued from there, and a number of other clubs were formed. I mean, there were clubs like Ulster, who we mentioned were involved in the exhibition. They were a key club in the early days. They won the Irish Cup. And another thing that happened was there was a lot of games kind of cross-channel. So if you take a team like Ulster, they went over. Actually, they played at Anfield before Liverpool did. They played at Anfield before Liverpool even existed. Wow. Because the story with Anfield is it was actually Everton's home ground. And Ulster went over and played a couple of games at Anfield. They played Everton. They played a team called Stanley. And Liverpool wasn't founded until 1892, when the Everton decided they were moving from Anfield, and the owner needed a football club to play there, so he founded.
So Liverpool founded got Everton Liverpool. Seconds, was it?
Well, it's, and as I said, Ulster played at Anfield long before Liverpool even existed. And actually, Cliftonville, Liverpool's first season of existence, one of their opponents were Cliftonville, who travelled over to play them in their very first season. So strong links going back there as well. So as I said, there was the first international then was played in 1882, when England defeated Ireland by 13-0 at Knock in East Belfast. So it remains a record win and a record defeat.
I was about to say, I think that's still our worst defeat, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thankfully. So. And who's playing this game? Is it the, I suppose you call them the British establishment, or is there a mix? Is it ordinary people, Joe Soaps, getting together playing their own football teams? I suppose the upper class, is it lower class? Who's playing this game right now at these times?
So in England, it had become kind of a middle class. So initially, the likes of Cliftonville and Myola Park would have been seen as middle-class teams. I mean, Cliftonville were a gentleman amateur club right up until the late 1960s. But if you take clubs that were formed like Distillery, and Distillery are still going to this day, they were workers, so ordinary manual labourers who were playing on a Saturday. So there was a few other clubs like that. So it was a bit of a mixture. And what you also had were army teams. So it was a team like the Gordon Highlanders who were based. So they were a Scottish Army regiment based here, and they actually won the Irish Cup as well. So you had a mixture between the gentlemen amateurs, the workers, the working man, and the army. And I suppose all three were involved. And I will go on to talk about, there's a photograph from 1908 I can talk about later on, which draws in a few of those as well. But back in the 1880s, it was that kind of a mix of a team. Myola Park, as I said, beat Cliftonville in the first Irish Cup final. I think it was Distillery beat them in the second one, if I remember rightly. So Myola Park, as I said, defeated Cliftonville in the first Irish Cup final. And it was Queen's Island actually won the second one. And Cliftonville eventually got their hands on the cup in 1883 when they defeated Ulster in the final.
I suppose at the time, does it capture the imagination of the public? Do we see crowds of the what, tens or the hundreds or the thousands, how is it capturing the public imagination at the time?
So the crowds at the time were along the lines of maybe 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, were stuff like that. I think getting into the first Irish Cup final at 1,500, the second at 2,000. I think you're getting well into you're getting 6,000-7,000 in the 1890s, but you actually had to go, the first five-figure crowd, I think, was 1905 when Distillery beat Shelburne in Belfast. So it took a while to really capture the imagination.
Is there what you might call a divide here in terms of Ireland, of course, at the time is not a republic yet. So is there sectarian lines here? Do we see those start to develop that early in terms of like Protestant clubs, Catholic clubs, those kind of things along that kind of skewed divide?
Not really. Not that anything I can really see. I mean, people thought football was played by everybody in those days. As I said, there were middle class, there was working class, there were army. I mean, people say the Bohemians probably traditionally were a Protestant club, and that they were founded partly anyway for the orphans of the army, and there was links with Trinity College, I believe. Some of these may be myths, actually, so they need to be. But the reality is that Catholics, Protestants, everyone played the game. So there wasn't really anything along a sectarian divide in those days. Certainly nothing that I'm aware of.
How does it kind of move on through the decades? Because it kind of goes from, I suppose, this kind of fringe sport with competition with, we'll say, rugby, kind of horse racing, cricket, you know, those kind of established games that were kind of already there. And in the space of a couple of decades, it's ramping up into, you know, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people watching this game. So is it simply a case that it just really captures the imagination of people, and they want to start their own football club, and, you know, the town down the road wants to compete against their neighbor, so they start a football club, and it kind of works like that?
Yeah, I think that's the way it happened, really. I mean, originally it was Belfast and the surrounding districts, although I suppose Castle Dawson is quite a distance from Belfast. But the first, typically the first club in what is now south of the border, first club in Dublin was Bohemian FC. So Bohs were founded in 1890. Shelburne were founded in 1895. And they were kind of the two powerhouse clubs in Dublin for many years. I mean, they met in the, well, Shelburne won the cup in 1906, but the Bohs actually met Shelburne
would argue they still are. They still are, well, after last season.
The Bohemians were very much so as well. I'm not getting into that argument. But I mean, Shelburne won the Irish Cup in 1906. They actually met in the Irish Cup final of 1908 in Dalymount Park. It went to, and Bohs won after a replay. They met again in 1911, and again it went to a replay, but this time Shelburne emerged victorious. So that was kind of the start of football spreading around the country. But I will go back to my own hometown of Limerick, because in November 1891, the Black Watch, now they were an army, a Scottish army regiment based in Limerick. So they played in the Irish Cup. And so the first record of senior football I can find in Limerick and in the Markets Field is on the 7th of November 1891, when the Black Watch played Linfield Rangers and defeated them 5-2 in the Irish Cup. And they actually went on 3 weeks later. They played the Lancashire Fusiliers and defeated them 8-2, actually. Went all the way to the final of the Irish Cup and lost to Linfield by 7-0 in the 1892 Irish Cup final. So, and the descriptions of the newspapers at the time were talking about really large crowds. I didn't see an attendance, but really large crowds turning out in Limerick to watch these games. But it didn't catch on. I mean, there was a report that they were expecting a club to be formed in Limerick shortly after that, but it never really happened, and that there wasn't senior football for almost half a century after that. So it even as you go into the 1890s, into the 1900s, the game is mainly played in Dublin and in the northeast of the Belfast, the greater Belfast area. So, as I said, there were teams like Myola Park, Glenavon from Lurgan were involved as well. So it's not just, I don't want to just restrict it to Belfast, but there was, Derry Celtic, St. Cullum's Hall Celtic from Derry, they got the Irish Cup finals as well in the 1890s, in the early 1900s. But so it wasn't just restricted to what is now Northern Ireland, to Belfast, but certainly in the Republic, it was mainly Shelburne and Bohemians. I should also mention the only other club from the Republic, from the South, to play in the Irish League was a team called Tritonville from Dublin, who played for one season, I think in 1912, 1913. And so otherwise it was just Shelburne and Bohemians flying the flag for what is now the Republic of Ireland, for want of a better word.
I wanted to kind of touch on that as well, just for the last part of the show. We've talked about the club scene, and I suppose it's early emergence around the country and where those kind of clubs came from. But what about from the international side of it? You kind of briefly mentioned it earlier. We got walloped by England. Yes. We should never talk of it again. But where is that now, and where do we see it as a national team that we would see, because we have two national teams essentially on this island. So is it an all encompassing kind of team that represents Ireland, or is it based east, northeast? What does it look like?
Well, I mean, I think it'll be another complete episode of its own. We can talk about the split between the IFA and the FAI. But so the Irish Football Association was founded in 1880, and it's still in existence. It's the governing body of football in Northern Ireland. So as I said, they played the first game in 1882, an unfortunate defeat to England. The home championship started in 1884 between England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales. The first international tournament of its kind, the oldest. It ran for 100 years. It finished in 1984. And if you ask anyone in Northern Ireland, they'll remind you that they are the reigning British champions, because they won the tournament in 1984 and 41
they
years
on. They
win
it every year by default.
Well, but so if you go back to 1884, that was when it started. A key thing, another key organisation that many football people don't know about is IFAB, the International Football Association Board. Now, that was founded in 1886 between the four home nations. And that was, as I had mentioned, there was the association rules, there were Scottish rules. So IFAB, the four associations, came together in 1886 and agreed on a common set of rules for football. Now, to this day, IFAB is still in existence, but it's not just the four associations. FIFA also has four seats in IFAB, and FIFA has the casting vote. But there is still a huge influence among the home associations with the laws of the game. And indeed, between the four associations, there is always a vice president of FIFA appointed, which is a huge amount of power and influence, which the IFA, for example, has, which we don't have in the FAI. Another important thing that came out of that stage from the international, from IFAB, was one of the things that came from the laws of the game was the penalty kick. And it was invented by a guy called William McCrum, who was a goalkeeper for a club called Milford Everton, who I believe they're certainly going up until recently. Milford is a small place in County Armagh. But William McCrum invented the penalty kick, and the IFA brought it to IFAB, and it was agreed in 1891 that the penalty kick came into the laws of the game. But going back to the national team, it's still in the IFA records, and now I suppose they're classed as Northern Ireland results, but it was an all-Ireland team. Those games, up until 1900, the home games were always played in Belfast across a variety of venues. The first game was played in Knock. Cliftonville Solitude was used. The Ulster Cricket Ground was used. There was a few other venues used. Windsor Park was later bought. But in 1900, on St. Patrick's Day, the first ever international in Dublin was played, when Ireland played England at Lansdowne Road. And England won 2-0 that day. And for the next 13 years, Dublin actually got quite a few games. So Scotland came to Dublin on a few occasions. England came back in 1912. The last IFA home international in Dublin was 1913 against Scotland.
So is this, I suppose, from a modern point of view, is this like almost like a Six Nations tournament? You played home 1 year, and then you played away next, and it kind of went a bit vice versa, that kind of way?
Yeah, exactly. So you played everyone once. So it was a four-team tournament, and the winners were crowned by whoever got 2 points for a win, one for a draw, and whoever got the... So the Northern Ireland or Ireland shared it in the early parts of the 20th century, but there have only been three outright wins for the IFA, for Ireland or Northern Ireland. I mentioned 1984. Northern Ireland also won it in the centenary year of 1980. But back in 1914 was a hugely, hugely significant win when Ireland became British champions, with quite a few Southerners as they are now on the team. Obviously, it was before any 1916 rising, any split of the associations, any independence for the Irish Free State as it became. But in 1914, Ireland defeated Wales, and on Valentine's Day 1914, a game known as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, they went to Middlesbrough, to Earsom Park, and defeated England by 3-0. And that was a hugely significant victory. A year earlier, actually, captained by Val Harris of Shelburne, Ireland had defeated England for the first time in Belfast. But the year later, to go and win at Earsom Park, and a draw with Scotland was enough to secure the home championship of 1914, and Ireland were outright champions. And
it's just like I just want to say, it's like a confirmation of all the stuff that had gone on. I suppose that the work that had gone on behind the background with Irish football, in terms of did the other associations take Irish football seriously? Like, did they just see it as this kind of like outlier out there? We don't really have to take them seriously. They're not really that good. So, you know, whatever. And they were kind of like on the fringes. They were in the tournament, not really taken seriously though, until they began to do this.
Yeah, I mean, traditionally England and Scotland were the powerhouses of the tournament. I mean, Wales and Ireland were, I suppose you could say, not taken seriously, but they didn't get too many wins. I mean, Ireland's first goal came against Wales, but they still lost 7-1. But gradually, they got the odd draw. They got a win over Scotland. They got, and over time, I'd have to look at the records, but Ireland were certainly competitive with Wales over time. But typically, it was Scotland and England. And Scotland were hugely competitive in the early years, and they would often beat England or be better than England. But so that win in 1914 was certainly a bit of an outlier. And as I said, Northern Ireland, the IFA, did go on to beat England in 1927, but there weren't too many wins. I mean, there was, off the top of my head, there was a win at Wembley in 1957, 1972. But it was rare that they actually got wins over England in the home championship. And that's over 100 years. I mean, you're talking a handful of wins. So they were hugely significant. They did get to defeat Scotland a bit more often, and I suppose Scotland's ascendancy wore down over the years. But definitely, I mean, to win the home championship wasn't such a big deal for England and Scotland as it would have been for Ireland and Wales, particularly back in the early days.
Gary, you mentioned earlier about the photograph, which we'll put up on socials and as well. But talk to us a little bit about what that photo is, and I suppose the significance of it as well.
Well, it's a photograph of a 1908 Ireland team that played England at Solitude. And it's just, I suppose, England won the game 3-1, but there's a few names that absolutely scream out at it from me. From the history of Irish football. The one person I want to mention, first of all, is the goal scorer, Dinny Hannan. And we talked before about the people who played the game, whether they were gentlemen or, let's say, workers. So Dinny was a solicitor from Athlone. Now, he was playing with Bohemians at the time, the gentleman amateur club, scored the Ireland goal. England got two late goals to win the game. The other significance of Dinny, the Athlone man, is he became the first ever captain of the Irish Free State, or what is now the Republic of Ireland, in the 1924 Olympics. So he was still playing football 16 years later. a huge man in the history of Bohemians, the history of Athlone Town. They can both fight over him because he was the Athlone captain that won the cup in 1924, a huge part of Bohemians' history as well. Another man in that photograph is Val Harris, who I mentioned in the 1913-1914. So Val Harris was a Shelburne legend. So he captained the first Shelburne team to win the Irish Cup in 1906, and he was also captain of that famous win over England in 1913. Played in the 1914 win over England. He was the Shelburne coach when they won the league in 1926, when they won the FA Cup in 1939. He was coach of the Irish Free State side after that as well. Another man in that photograph is a Galway man by the name of Sandy Craig, or Alexander Craig, known as Sandy. So Sandy is he played for Ireland for 10 years, also played in that 1914 British Championship win. He holds a couple of records to this day. He made almost 200, I think it's 194 appearances for Rangers. So from what is now the Republic of Ireland, he still has made more appearances for Rangers than anybody else. But he holds an even more remarkable Rangers record, because a decade at the club, he never won a major trophy. So I think that's, I don't know 100%, I can state for sure it's a record, but I think it's very likely that it is. He was injured and missed a Scottish Cup win, and Rangers didn't win the league or didn't win the Scottish Cup otherwise, with him getting a medal. So a quite remarkable record, and somebody who's probably forgotten in the history of Galway football. Another man in the photo is the goalkeeper Billy Scott of Everton. Because for must be 20 or 30 years, the goalkeepers for Ireland were either Billy Scott of Everton or his brother Elisha Scott of Liverpool. And there were two legendary goalkeepers with their clubs, with Ireland. And of course, Elisha Scott went on to be a very, very famous, successful manager with Belfast Celtic, managing them for many years and winning numerous trophies, and right up to when they went out of football in 1949.
It's interesting. How did they end up in Liverpool? Was it just they moved there, or were they actually asked to come play? Is that a transfer? Or how did it work?
I suppose I don't know. I mean, the short answer is I don't know. But I mean, imagine in those days, it was still the case that a lot of the better players did go cross-channel. So if you look at the Ireland teams from that time, there were some home-based players like Dinny Hannan, who was a solicitor, so I suppose would have had money, would have been middle class, could afford to play football as an amateur. Whereas many of the others were, let's say, ordinary working men who needed the money. And I mean, they couldn't afford to have a hobby or a pastime and to play football for free. So if somebody was offering them money, they were certainly going to take it, and they were going to play. So a lot of players did go cross channel. The Ireland team was a bit of a mixture between players playing over in England or Scotland and players playing at home.
Just interesting that you mentioned the money there as well. Are players getting, maybe not necessarily paid, but are they getting appearance fees or things like that? And does it, I suppose, change the game in terms of, do players now say, well, if you want me, you're going to have to pay for me? Is there player strikes on the horizon for better pay? Those kind of things. Did these kind of things start to emerge early in the 1900s?
So, yeah, they were definitely strikes. I don't have a huge amount of detail on, certainly on this island, on strikes. I mean, some clubs were, like Cliftonville and Bohemians, were amateur clubs. They both remained strictly amateur, gentlemen amateur clubs, right up until the late 1960s. Clubs like Shelburne, Ulster, etc., Distillery, they were working men clubs, so they were certainly people who were being paid by their employer. They were given extra time off for playing football, etc. In some ways, I suppose they were typically still amateur, but they were there were certainly privileges to being a workplace team. If you played for a distillery, for example, you might have worked in the distillery helping to make whiskey, but you did get time off or extra time for playing football, etc.
And we are in that period as well of, I suppose, the Industrial Revolution as it begins to kick off as well. So you have, you know, I suppose, people who are working all hours of the day, etc., and they don't have much free time, all of those types of things. So to dedicate themselves to playing football and to be part of it as well was, I suppose, in a way, was a big thing to take on too.
Yeah, it was huge because it wasn't the case of the 5-day week in those days. You worked Monday to Friday. You also worked Saturday morning. And I suppose it was only the advent of the 5.5-day week that allowed football to happen at 3 o'clock on a Saturday. So the working man, and I don't mean to sound sexist, but it was very much a male-dominated sport at that time. The working man would finish work and could go and watch football or go and play football. And often the person working beside you, they might go off and get their boots to play at 3 o'clock, and you might be going out to watch them play. So there was quite a bit of that as well.
To loop it all the way back to our story at the start of the show, we've kind of established that the milestone there with McAleary and football coming to Ireland, etc. But if you could sum up those, I suppose, those 30, 40 years between, I suppose, the late 1870s from that story to round about World War One, where are you in terms of football and how does it, I suppose, develop across those decades?
So, yeah, I mean, it had, that was the, so McAleary, certainly that 1878 game, whether it was organised by McAleary or not, was certainly a significant milestone. There was certainly football being played on this island before that, either by Scottish rules or association rules. The founding of the IFA in 1880 obviously was hugely significant. The founding of the Irish Cup in 1881, the first international in 1882. The crowds grew significantly, but they grew from maybe 1,000 or 2,000 to crowds such as 10,000, 12,000 would have been the norm. Another significant factor was Bohemians purchasing Dalymount Park in 1901. So, as I said, the first international in Dublin had been in 1900 in Lansdowne Road. But by Bohemians moving from the Phoenix Park, where they were founded in 1890, to Dalymount Park in 1901, that provided a football ground which was capable of hosting Irish Cup finals, of hosting the Ireland national team. There were a number of games played there. And football certainly grew right through the early years of the 20th century. And it became a huge deal. You can see that in the newspaper columns it used to occupy as the years went on as well. It's very hard to get details. A lot of football went unreported back in the 1870s. But by the early 1900s, right up to the outbreak of the First World War, there was football was certainly much more important. Those national team games were big events. And I even go back to the 1906. I mentioned Shelburne were the first team, first Dublin team to win the Irish Cup. The newspaper reports about Ringsend and Sandymount of tar barrels being lit, of mad, wild celebrations that went on for so long. It was a huge, Shelburne winning the cup in 1906 was a huge deal. And some of these get airbrushed. I mean, a lot of the history of football on this island, and let's say what is now the Republic of Ireland, before 1921 gets airbrushed out of history. But I mean, Bohemians winning the cup in 1908, Shelburne won three Irish Cups. Well, they won two on the pitch and one by default. None of the clubs actually won the league. Shelburne were runners-up 1 year. But there's a huge deal. There was huge history here. There were a lot of football internationals played in Dublin, which are generally, I suppose, forgotten about or written out of the history books.
But it's the foundational period, though, isn't it? I mean, this is where it all begins and where it begins to grow and where it begins to grow in terms of the kind of football that we even see now, which is football embedded right slap bang in the middle of communities in housing estates. A lot of stadiums now, even in the League of Ireland, slap bang in the middle of housing estates. So very much community-based football that begins in that earlier period.
Absolutely. It's very much the people's game. I mean, that's the... It was the game of the... I suppose I said it was the game of everyone, but it was very much the game of the working man. I mean, rugby had probably been established earlier. The IRFU was founded in 1875. But rugby very, very much was a middle-class, upper-class game. And even to this day, with the exception of Limerick, it is very, still strongly a middle-class, upper-class game. Whereas football became the game of the working man. It was very much in the cities. You had the Bohemians on the north side in Phibsborough and the Phoenix Park. They were the north side team. You had Shelburne in Irishtown, Ringsend, Sandymount. I know they were the team of the south side. I know they're in Talca Park today, but they're very much, their roots are in Ringsend and in the south side of Dublin. They were teams that were followed in the community. They mattered. They were local teams. And those two clubs are still hugely influential in football to this day. As you said, Shelburne are our current champions.
Yeah. And don't forget as well, the company teams too, in terms, you mentioned distillery and so on. And I know ones came later too. So these weren't just, you know, football clubs. They were football clubs where, you know, you went to work with the fans, you went to work with the players and those kind of things too, as well. So very much the building blocks of a footballing community. I know in our next episode, we're going to take it from around about that World War One period, which I suppose during that World War One period, you could probably take a few stories to make up its own episode as well, just to give us a brief insight into what people might kind of see coming next. What do we see next coming in the next, I suppose, 5-10 years of Irish football from that period on?
Well, I suppose the next big thing, and we go on to talk about, would have to be the split. There wasn't that much football happened during World War One. International football was stopped. The schism, the split, whatever you want to call it. And the good thing about it is the actual history is not in dispute. So we can talk about what happened and how the association split, but there is no dispute between the historians north of the border or south of the border on what actually happened. It's generally agreed. It's generally accepted as fact. So, and I suppose we'll very much focus from there on south of the border and the FAI. But in 1921, the Leinster Football Association, as it was then, broke away from the Irish Football Association. And that's a huge story. It's a podcast all on its own. And indeed, it actually happened prior to the partition of this island. So the Leinster Football Association, which is often forgotten as well, broke away from the Irish Football Association before the war, before the War of Independence had concluded and before Michael Collins had signed the treaty, etc. So there's a football history that actually happened in conjunction with a very, very turbulent time in the history of this island as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And we'll cover that in the next episode. Really interesting time. Revolution off the pitch and on it as well. Gary, thanks very much for joining us.
Great, thanks.
Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks again to the thousands and thousands of you that have listened to the show so far. We're only just beginning, and with your support, we'll be doing some great things over the next year. If you're new to the show, why not go back and listen to all of our previous shows to see how Irish football has developed over the past 130 to 140 years. Normal service resumed next week. Bye for now.